Hey, Don, we were just talking to the guys over at Path Projects, and they were letting us know that there have been a lot of TRN listeners that have ordered Path Projects gear.
And there's a good reason for that, because it's awesome. In fact, Scott, you and I, coincidentally, not coincidence, we're both sitting here in our Path Projects gear. It's almost every day that I have something from Path on somewhere.
The good news is those people that ordered have reordered. That means they've discovered exactly what we've been talking about for over a year now. Path Projects gear feels good. It's good quality. It's a great price because they do have a direct-to-consumer model.
When you look good, you feel good. And I think I look good in this stuff, Scott.
And when you look good and feel good, you usually perform well. So I think that you need to try it. If you haven't, go to pathprojects.com. You can also get there by going to our partners page and linking over, clicking on the banner there. If you have tried it, maybe it's time for some more.
Go to pathprojects.com and take a look around and see what you would like to wear.
Do you experience stress, have anxiety, chronic pain, or have trouble sleeping at least once a week?
Scott, you had me at stress.
Well, you're not alone, Mr. Freeman, because a lot of us do. Let me tell you a little bit about Feels, F-E-A-L-S. It's premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep.
Hey, Feels naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, or pain, or sleeplessness, whatever you have. It will help you in those areas.
There's a lot of companies out there that are pushing CBD. Let us tell you a little bit about why Feels is different. Number one is they have real human support.
And that's huge, Scott, because for many, this is different and new. And to have someone to actually talk to about dosage, about symptoms, about results, that's big.
They also have a thing called their Feels Flight, which is different dosages. So you can order the flight and find out what dosage is best for you.
So if you want to get some Feels, here's what you do. You go to feels.com/TRN and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping.
That's Feels, feals.com/TRN. And don't forget, they have memberships there too.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
I'm trying to move. That's all you got. That's all you can do right now. You got it, Dylan. You got it, man. You can rally.
Mile 76. How you feeling?
You know, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm tired.
What do you think? What do you think of the course today? What do you expected?
It's tough.
Yeah. Uh oh. Mr. Jones Wilkins is still hunched over.
There, where were we?
We were about to run.
Yes, I think we better do that.
All right. That's Ultra.
All right. Hey, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And today is one of our famous
We're not famous. Podcasts. No, favorite. Not favorite. Okay. It's an F word,
We're starting off rotten already. It's Grab Bag. And we have invited Coach Matt Lay and also author and runner Alex Hutchinson on. If you don't know Matt, he's an endurance athlete. He has a PhD in medical physiology, and he's an assistant professor of health and human performance at the College of Idaho. You can read some of his articles regularly in Ultra Running Magazine, and he also coaches for Charmin Ultra, residing in the wonderful cold area of Boise, Idaho. Hey, Matt.
Hey, how you guys doing?
And good. And Alex, he's been on our podcast a few times, become a quick favorite. He's the author of the book that we covered in, I think, three or four podcasts called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. A great read. If you haven't read it, you need to go get that book.
Or a great listen if you want to listen to it, because it's available on audio as well.
Or you can do both.
Yep.
Read along with as Tinkerbell rings her little bell.
Like a bedtime story.
So we're going to do Grab Bag. And just to give Alex, this is Alex's first Grab Bag. Matt has done kind of a a little bit of a kind of grab bag.
A version.
So he's a version. Who wants to start? You want to start, Matt, Don?
Oh, yeah.
Are you ready, or do you want me to start?
No, you should start, and that'll give me a chance to level up.
Okay, here's mine. Breathing, okay? Breathing is this is an article that I found. You have to breathe to
Alex
survive.
Put a thumbs down to breathing.
Totally against breathing.
Breathing is the number one thing that beginners and intermediate runners do wrong.
Hmm. Maybe you found this in an article.
I did.
This isn't just something you hypothesized on the way over.
It was actually from, I believe, Runner's World.
Okay.
They said that it's a little counterintuitive, but most distance runners are breathing too much. And by breathing too much, it's not necessarily bringing too much oxygen in, but we're not getting rid of all the CO2 in our lungs.
Hmm.
And when you have too much CO2, that can cause problems. One of the problems that they identified is it can lead to cramping.
Hmm. Interesting. So what do we need to do? Exhale more? Twice? Exhale twice, breathe in once. Is that what the remedy, Scott?
Actually, what they said is to time, if you can work on timing your breathing with your cadence and your step. Is one way.
Have you gentlemen ever heard of such chaos as Scott's presenting here?
Yeah, that's what I hear from like my intro exercise phys students who haven't learned anything yet.
Oh,
that they're breathing too much?
What?
That they're breathing too much or
this
not?
This concept I believe he's referring to.
Concept. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it seems as likely as being able to breathe, inhale twice and exhale once at the same time somehow. I don't know of any physiology. None of the physiology makes to me at all in terms of what they're describing with regards to CO2 causing cramping. And okay, if you breathe more than you need to, hyperventilate as we call it, then yes, you get rid of more CO2. But that doesn't have anything to do with being able to prevent cramps or breathe more or anything. It's the pulmonary system, like our ability to breathe is incredibly regulated. It's so finely tuned, regulated that it's one of the things that surprises students to know that when we're at VO2 max and we're going as hard as we can, we're actually not even breathing as hard as we possibly can. Like if I just told you to stand still and breathe as hard as you could, you'd be able to breathe more air in and out than you do it during VO2 max. Uh-huh. So it's not limiting. It's not the thing that prevents us really from being able to exercise. For most people, there are a few super, super elite athletes when maybe the amount of air they can move in and out is the thing that limits it. But for most of us, don't worry about it. Just
so breathe. You've never had to coach a beginner or intermediate runner on how to breathe better?
No.
it would be like trying to control your heart chambers. It's all automated. It's just on its own. Don't get in the way. Let it happen.
Don't get in the way. It's the autonomic nervous system.
Ah,
so
there's the key word. Well. Auto.
Yes.
Alex, what studies have you read out there on breathing?
I'm glad Matt brought the hatchet early because it saves me from being a bad guy. I have gotten this question a lot, and I've gotten into long arguments in like the comments sections of old WordPress blogs with people who are convinced that you can, you know, reach a new level of performance by breathing differently. And like Matt says, it's regulated pretty normally, and it's definitely beginning runners who have the most trouble with breathing and have the feeling that they're breathing too much. And my diagnosis, and I'm not a doctor, my diagnosis is they're breathing a lot when they're beginning runners because they're not fit yet. So they're going out and running like, why am I breathing like a tank engine? Because you're not fit. You're trying something that's hard and you're supposed to breathe that much. And the guy you're running with who's already been running for a while, he's breathing less because he's more fit. So there are a bunch of nuances you can get into with breathing. The synchronization thing is interesting. There's lots of research on like, is there some benefit to letting your breathing become synchronized to your strides? And that often happens, and it depends, and there's not one pattern that's right. It often depends on your intensity. You might be two steps in, two steps out, or two steps in, three steps out, or three steps in, two steps out. And there's, you know, you can pretend or maybe see some pattern that this somehow relaxes the pattern generating parts of your brain or something. But practically speaking, there's no obvious benefit. And there's also stuff about, like, oh, breathing through your nose is going to make you better. And that I don't even want to go there. I just did. But
what about the tape on top of the nose? Should I get one of those soon?
The Breathe Right.
The Breathe Right strip.
Again, like Matt said, it's not getting air in is not really a limiting factor.
All right.
Now, one last thing I'll say is in terms of the cramps, I had a lot of cramping problems in college cross country. I would get a stitch, 5K into races. And one of the sort of received wisdoms that you get is that, oh, maybe you're breathing too shallowly. And it's... I'm not sure. I don't know of any science for it, but what I felt like was sometimes in the course of a race, I could become aware that when I was super nervous, and often when it was in cold conditions, I'd notice that I was breathing pretty shallowly, and I could consciously sort of slow my breathing down a little bit. And I don't think the breathing of the carbon dioxide was affecting the stitch, but it may be a way of trying to relax. If tension is a problem, like, you know, the hip bone is connected to the knee bone and stuff. It's all holistic. So there may be things where if you're super nervous and that's causing you to kind of breathe super shallow a little bit, it may be being conscious of, hey, just relax, slow your breathing down if you want, can help get you into a better mental state. But I think that's more psychological than it is physiological.
Is there any science behind breathing with your abdomen versus breathing with your chest? You know, I think we've talked about this before, where a lot of people, you know, when they inhale, they go with their chest rather than breathing with their gut.
I don't know, Matt, do you have any insights on that?
I don't have any insights other than, like, the pattern of breathing is typically you first tend to increase the amount of volume and then you increase the frequency. So you may initially start with a deeper breath and then just increase the number of breaths you take per minute as exercise intensity increases. But I don't know. Like, does it fatigue your abs somehow? Or, I mean, there actually... Now that I think about it, there is this really cool, fascinating study that looked at, we think of breathing as not being super consequential in terms of how much energy it takes to breathe. But there's this guy, I think his name is Marcus Ammon at University of Utah. And he did some studies where they basically short circuited the breathing apparatus. So they put people on ventilator and saw if they could increase their delivery of oxygen to working muscles rather than, say, I mean, our ventilatory muscles are working, but say if we could get rid of those, could we increase performance? And he did show some increase in performance there. So it could be not that the air itself is the problem, the limiting thing, but the amount of oxygen that's required by the ventilatory muscles to use could be one of the limiting things. And it's like 10 to 20% sometimes of our total oxygen extraction is occurring from the ventilatory muscles. So that's kind of interesting.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we're ready to move on?
We're done with breathing.
I'm ready to get hammered myself, Scott. So let me go along and let's set the trend of being hammered, and then we'll get to the real deal from our guest. Yeah, yeah. So my study is called Pushing the Limits of Human Endurance. And it suggests that our bodies might become a bit more efficient the more we do this physical activity stuff, which makes sense. To most of us, it seems intuitive. The more we work out, the more calories you burn, the better it is. But there was a study in 2012 that said, hey, you know what? Maybe we get a little more efficient as we practice this. And so they went and found, and this is one for the people sitting in their desk. This said, finally a win for sedentary people. Because here's what it said. In 2012, there was a study of energy expenditure among modern hunter-gatherers, for instance, found that despite being in motion most all day, the tribe's people burned about the same number of daily calories as those that sit behind a desk all day. You got to love that. Scott, you better link this, and I'm sure we're going to get hammered here in a second, but link this article to help support me. In the effect, the tribe's people's bodies seem to have found ways to reduce their overall daily energy expenditure as they continued to move. And so they did part of this. I already see Matt smiling here. This is going to go well.
He's going to
this is not going to go well. I'm just going to keep talking. So they did a study in 2015. There was a race across America where these people ran for, what was it, daily, a marathon a day for up to 60 days or something. Maybe I'm confusing a couple of studies, but here we go. They found that the people that when they started this event, this race across America, they were burning 6,200 calories a day. And at the end, at the same pace and the same distance, they were burning 600 calories less per day. Meaning maybe they were hypothesizing that their bodies were becoming more efficient and more effective.
I think that makes sense.
On my facts, it makes sense. Yeah. Based on what I told you, it makes sense. And so they were at the end, the conclusion of this article, it says, maybe that's why some people aren't losing weight despite running. That they may be out there becoming more efficient and a bit discouraged at looking the scale not changing or their body fat percentage not changing as they become more efficient at running. Okay, there's a lot of stuff to knock down out there. I don't know where you guys want to start. Do you want to start with tribes people and people sitting at desks being both equal athletes, or where do you want to go with this?
Well, I guess my main question about the study, without having read it or just, you know, seen any of the data, is were they normalizing for body weight? Because that's a huge factor in terms of resting and the expenditure.
That's true. They matched the people of equal size when they were doing their calorie content or their burning rate of calories.
Okay. And then was it equal like fat-free mass? Because even more important than body mass, it's how much lean mass we have in terms of energy expenditure.
Hey, those are good.
So you could have someone, someone, two people the same exact weight, one who's 5% body fat, one who's 25% body fat. The 5% body fat's going to burn more calories resting than the other person. But I don't know if that really makes sense, given that probably the person sitting in the chair is not going to be the leaner one of those two groups. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you guys think about just becoming more efficient? Have you ever seen anything on that? Our bodies becoming more efficient at managing calories. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think in terms of first of all, let me just say on the hunter-gatherer data, it was an interesting study. It was one study. I remember reading it at the time. It's a very little bit of data. So I'd like to see more evidence. I think, put it this way. I have a really, really hard time believing that we have such a fine-tuned system that we all burn the same amount of calories every day, no matter what we do, that I can go out and run 100 miles and tomorrow I can do nothing and I'm going to burn the same amount of calories. I don't think that's remotely plausible. So is it possible that over millennia, the HASDA hunter-gatherers have developed ways of efficiently, you know, not burning too many calories, even though they're very active? Sure, maybe. But to transpose that and to say, oh yeah, if I sit at my desk or if I go exercise, it doesn't make any difference to the amount of calories I burn because my body is magically going to compensate. You got to sit at your desk for generations, I think, before your body's going to magically compensate for that. I think it's an interesting result and it's good research, but I think in the headlines at the time when that came out, it got wildly sort of overinterpreted and overgeneralized. In terms of the Race Across America stuff and the idea that we become more efficient, that was also some interesting stuff. Look, if I spent 60 days running, I sure hope I would get more efficient. And I imagine if you took a picture of me running on day, or some video analysis of me running on day one and running on day 60, you'd be like, wow, his feet don't even come off the ground anymore. It looks like he's moonwalking. That sort of extreme test, it wouldn't be surprising if it shaved off some extraneous motions and sources of energy burning. And maybe there's something going on metabolically too, but Joe, who goes for a half hour jog every morning, is not, you know, experiencing the same thing as someone who just ran across America. These are so again, it's like, this is really important information for people who are running across the United States. but we should be cautious about generalizing it to whether exercise is good for you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Matt or Scott? Are we ready to move on to one of the other real studies? Gentlemen.
Those were definitely real studies. They're good ones. It's just, we got to be cautious about it.
Matt.
Yeah, there is parallels with the running across America and sort of just weight loss in general, where when you lose weight, you tend to become more metabolically efficient, and it makes it really hard to keep the weight off. That's one thing that people really struggle with is keeping the weight off, and it's because they're actually becoming more efficient. It's related to this idea called the set point theory, which your body weight, you gain weight, you establish a new set point, so it's hard to go down from there. So why prevention is such a key thing in terms of body weight loss. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Good stuff. Who would like to go next? Alphabetical order or reverse of alphabetical order? One of those two.
Let's let the new guy have
right.
a shot.
All right, Alex.
Hey, Alex.
Okay, I'm gonna go right in the deep end. I figured I'd look back at some of the studies I've written about recently and pick the ones that have made the most people angry.
Yeah, good.
I've managed to make a lot of people angry recently. So let's talk about stretching. There was a review let me just check what journal it was. It was Sports Medicine. Yeah, in the journal Sports Medicine, which was basically called The Case Against Static Stretching or something like that. And it or why stretching shouldn't be considered a key component of physical fitness. And it kind of sums up the last 100 years of research on stretching, specifically on static stretching. This is the sitting on the ground, trying to touch your toes, that kind of thing. And said, what do we think stretching is doing for us? Is it doing those things? And does it deserve to be mentioned in things like the physical activity guidelines for Americans, where it's listed as one of the 5 key components of physical fitness? And it makes the claim that there's little to no evidence that it reduces injuries, or that it helps you recover after workouts, or that it's part of a good warm-up that makes you less likely to get injured, or that it enhances performance as part of, so whether you stretch before or after, or wake yourself up in the middle of the night and stretch, there's just very little evidence that does anything except make you more flexible. And even that, a lot of the supposed increase in flexibility is seems to be an increase in your willingness to tolerate that stretching discomfort. So you stretch and stretch and stretch. It's not that your hamstrings get longer. It's just that you sort of turn down the distress signals and you're just willing to stretch the hamstrings to a greater degree. So any review like that, it wasn't a systematic review. It was a narrative review, meaning this is one guy cherry picking the evidence that supports his perspective, but it happened to dovetail with my own individual biases. So I was like, this is gold. I'll sum this up in an article. And since then I've been, battered by emails and messages telling me that I don't understand anything and I'm an idiot. And, one day I'll realize that I've been misleading people and leading them to a premature death by discouraging stretching.
Premature death. That's heavy.
So what say you guys?
What's your opinion, Matt?
I think my biases is kind of aligned with Alex's here, and that's maybe because I just don't like to stretch, and I'm inflexible. But I do think that there's been enough evidence, and whenever I pull up some of these papers for my students, they're always shocked to see like that static stretching is not the best thing for them. And I think the one study I remember is they did like a 3K time trial, and they did static stretching before or no static stretching, and those that static stretched were like slower than those that did not stretch, as one example. So, I'm sort of in agreement with Alex on this one.
Yeah, I'll throw this out there. We've talked in the past about elastic properties of tendons and muscles, and that maybe there's an advantage for us as runners to have that a little more elasticity to spring back for that spring-type mechanism to propel us and move forward. that stretching may elongate those tendons and muscles, and we lose that. So this is my position of why I don't stretch at all, because I want to try to have as much elastic properties as I can in those tendons and muscles. Any thought on that?
Yeah. So I think there is some pretty good evidence. Well, there's some evidence that's absolutely true. That first of all, if you take cross-sectional studies of people, so you take a big group of people and you say, I'm going to measure how flexible you are, and I'm going to measure how efficient you are while you run. So how much energy it takes to maintain a given pace. And they find that the more flexible you are, the more energy it takes for you to sustain a given pace. And they've found that in among elite runners, and they've found that among sedentary college students. So it seems to be true that idea that being a little less flexible, it may have disadvantages, but it also may have some advantages in terms of having those tight coiled springs that return energy. And forgot what I was going to say next, but anyway, yeah. So I think there's evidence that's true. Oh yeah, I was going to say there's probably not a coincidence that both Matt and I have come to our biases naturally because we're inflexible, and so really we're just looking for excuses because we hate stretching. Well, there is evidence that there are some genes linked to flexibility that make. I mean, I hate sitting cross-legged on the floor. It's not just because I'm old. I am old, but it's also even in kindergarten, I had trouble sitting cross-legged on the floor. I was always inflexible. And those same genes are linked to running autonomy. People who end up running are probably on some remote level more likely to be inflexible because they tend to be a little better at that sport.
And I remember learning about tendons. They have different fibers, a different percentage of elastic and plastic fibers that each of us are uniquely designed so that some people are just inherently more flexible than others. And forcing something to change your fiber type in your tendons, it really isn't possible just from stretching. You can't change your DNA.
And those flexible people end up as phys ed teachers telling us that we all should be able to bend over backwards and touch our heels.
Yeah, but you know, there is a space, I think, for making sure that you're flexible. If you're a football player and you're on the high school team and you plan on somebody jumping on your back at some time, it's probably good to have as much flexibility in that circumstance as you can.
Or a gymnast that's doing backflips and stuff and contorting.
Yeah. But there's probably a filter involved there. The non-flexible people probably don't find their way to the gymnastic floor.
That's probably right.
But yeah, there are definitely some activities where range of motion itself is a limiting factor. And even if you're a hockey goaltender or something like that, you have to be able to do the splits. And most guys don't start out being able to do the splits. So there are situations where it matters. And there may be situations for runners too. I don't know. The evidence, there's no evidence to really tell us either way. But it may be that, you know, tightness in your ITB is going to cause injury problems and stretching that. I don't know. Like there's certainly plausible theories why some flexibility, maybe not general, like you have to stretch everything, but maybe you need to be aware of personal areas of tightness and that'll keep you running smoothly. And those things are hard to test in studies. So I wouldn't say that it's definitively proven that no one should stretch. I would just say it's not definitively proven that people should stretch. So for people like me who hate it, that I take comfort from that.
Final word, Matt, or do you want ready to move on to yours?
Oh, I have a quick comment. One of the sub, like the fifth or sixth topic I was going to talk about is related to this, and that is foam rolling. They said if you're not really big on stretching, that maybe you should not forget about foam rolling, especially post run, where it can stretch out the myofascial tissue. I don't know. Have you guys seen any advantages or any studies on foam rolling versus stretching, or is it the same thing?
Well, it's not the same thing.
Okay. I don't do either, so I don't know.
I think I view foam rolling as akin to, you know, maybe we're all old enough to remember pre-plasma TVs banging on the side of the TV, and sometimes it fixes the picture. And foam rolling hurts. I used to do it, and so you know you're doing something to yourself, and you know you're probably changing the tissue properties. I'm a little skeptical of some of the explanations offered by foam roller manufacturers about the magically de-adhering the something or others or whatever. I have trouble following it, but there's lots of things that might do something. If something is wrong, doing nothing doesn't fix it. doing something sometimes fixes it, even if we don't really know why or it's not any rationale. So, yeah, I put foam rolling in that category. Maybe it does something.
I love the banging on the side of the TV comparison. That is good. And if things are stuck together, it doesn't make sense by smashing them further together that they now are free. So I'm with you. Hit the TV on the side of the tube that's bad. That's what you do.
Yeah, it's a loose connection. That all injuries stem from a loose connection.
All right, Matt, it's your turn. What topic you got for us?
All right, I have a more health related topic.
Oh, great!
If that's okay for you guys.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so one of the things that I've been interested in, sort of from a research perspective on my own, is just the variability of response to exercise that people have. So whether that's the variability in how much they improve, or how much how much they improve performance wise, or how much they improve different health wise things. So we know that exercise prevents the progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes. And so I've been interested in, okay, but it doesn't prevent it in everyone. And there's still a significant amount of variation for that. It doesn't work for everyone. And so there's this paper that came out in the journal Cell Metabolism recently called "The Gut Microbiome Fermentation Determines the Efficacy of Exercise for Diabetes Prevention." And so that's a fancy way of saying that they think the microbiome is responsible for how people respond to exercise and whether or not they improve their glucose control due to the exercise, which is pretty crazy. So people who had like say an ideal microbiome were more likely to improve and lower their fasting levels of blood glucose, their HbA1cs, all these healthy parameters, than other people were able to. Which was pretty cool. And they were able to show this in humans, how they had different microbiomes, and then take those microbiomes and put them in mice and basically replicate the same exact thing by looking at the different metabolites that the microbiome produced, which was pretty cool. So that was the study that I came across, which is very different than our typical ultra study, performance study, stretch study. So what do you guys think about that?
Is a microbiome something that you can control or adjust?
Yes, definitely. So diet has a big effect on the microbiome. So eating fermented foods, that kombucha, that kimchi, that cabbage, I'll go with sourdough and beer also in there. those can all affect your microbiome. And where you live affects your microbiome. So we share about 60%, I think is the number I remember, of our microbiome between people. So 40% of it is controlled by the environment. Really? Exercise alters the microbiome. Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting.
So there's also a recent case study of a elite Western States runner who they did microbiome reports leading up to the race, right before, and then after the race. And that just was published, I don't know, a couple weeks ago. And they show the changes that occur in the microbiome from a 100-mile race as well. Yeah.
So to Scott's question, how do you get your microbiome evaluated, and can you manipulate it through some specific diet or changes that you can do?
We need to go eat some kimchi, Freeman.
Well, now you mentioned a bunch of things: sourdough, beer, and cabbage, etc. Are those all good for you? Are those the things that move your biomarkers in a positive direction?
Typically, it seems that if people eat whole foods, right, a lot less processed foods, that tends to create a healthier microbiome. And the area is so fast and upcoming, the research, because for a long time we didn't know that the microbiome was as diverse as it was. And only since we've been able to sequence, genetically sequence all of these different bugs in our gut, have we been able to see how diverse it is. And so that's been really a technological issue that's been overcome in the last decade, which is pretty fascinating. And so there are some companies now that you can, go to the bathroom, provide them a sample, send it off in the mail, and they'll get back to you with sort of the general composition of your microbiome. So you could track it over time. You could see what you eat. And I'm going to guess that sort of like the response to exercise, the response to the same food is going to result in different compositions for different people. And how that's controlled, I don't think we're really close to knowing, but it's a fascinating area of research. If you can, you can even look back a few years ago, and there's articles titled like poop doping. So like the idea that maybe performance is affected by the microbiome. And there's a few studies in animals that, that does show that, which is pretty fascinating. And the whole area is really, I think it's going to be interesting to follow. There's going to definitely be some people trying to make some money on selling you, you know, products that, you know, enhance your supposedly good microbiome and whatnot. But I think we're a ways off from showing any efficacy of that.
I think I remember hearing that if you take some antibiotics, you could destroy your microbiome, and that you need to then think about, you know, replenishing and drinking something like kefir or something is positive to do that. Any truth to that?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, it's an antibiotic, right?
So yeah.
It destroys most of the microbiome. And it, unfortunately, it's the guys that like aren't completely destroyed that are sort of promiscuous and will take advantage of the lack of other bacteria in your stomach that may, or in your gut, that might come back in fuller force. And so you might redistribute your microbiome in a not so positive way. So that's why they do say taking probiotics, prebiotics, the difference being that that one is the food or the substance that you want the good microbiome to eat in your gut, and the other being you're actually taking the bacteria themselves. Those are prescribed in some cases for people who go on really strong antibiotics. They may get prescribed a probiotic after they go off the antibiotics to help reestablish their gut health.
Alex, we haven't been fair to you. You want to jump in on this?
Yeah, this is making me feel really worried because I have a prescription for antibiotics in my backpack. I just got back from the doctor.
And, just go grab some kimchi, Alex.
And they're going to call in hours and let me know whether I should go on this. Yeah, I've been following this area with great, great interest. And the two studies Matt mentioned sound fascinating, the Western States one and this one, that I'm going to have to go dig them up after. It's interesting. I mean, I think my general sense, like Matt has been saying, is it's a really fascinating area that's telling us something about how the body works. And the challenging part is making the leap to, so what do I do with this information? And it's like, there's only so much kimchi I can eat. That stuff is pretty powerful. And so one of the questions that I have is like, okay, this study in Cell that found these differences in how people respond to exercise, I wonder if there were any differences before the exercise started. If you said, okay, we've got these people who've got the right microbiome to respond to exercise and these people who've got the wrong microbiome, what determined those differences? Can we figure out like the people who had the right microbiome or the people who were already doing a little exercise or who were already eating this or that, or who were washing their hands after they went to the bathroom, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I think that would be nice to know, because that might be a more sustainable way of changing the microbiome. Because what they do find is like, let's say it takes probiotics. It's like, wow, you can change your microbiome by eating this stuff. And then you forget to take it one day and your microbiome goes like right back to normal. It's hard to make sustainable changes in your microbiome unless you're doing something that, you know, you sustain every day. So I'd like to know the patterns that lead in the first place to having a good microbiome, because I suspect that'll be more powerful than having a pill or a, you know, a shot of sourdough and beer and kimchi every night.
Mm. I'd be interested to know if our microbiomes have changed in our cultures over time. Did we have a better microbiome 50 years ago because we were eating less processed food and more natural foods?
There's a big thing called the hygiene hypothesis, which is that when kids started to pay attention to not eating dirt and stuff like that, it led us to stop taking in so many different forms of you know, different bacteria and pathogens and stuff. And I'm probably mixing up various different things because it's not just about the microbiome, but about the immune system and everything. But I think the general theme is that 100 years ago, before widespread refrigeration and antibiotics and all that stuff, we had very, very diverse microbiomes. And my understanding is that I think it's very hard to put your finger on this is a good bug and this is a bad bug. I mean, there are some that are better than others, but for the most part, having diversity is what seems to be really helpful. And so that's why I don't wash my hands after using the bathroom.
Well, thank you for that. And that's why you have that cough right now, Alex.
Yeah, excuse me while I go to the doctor again.
and probably further supports, I mean, what microbiome is happening in infants, breastfeeding versus non-breastfeeding? I think that would be a real mechanism to kickstart your microbiome.
Well, and even not to get too into the details here, but a vaginal birth versus a C-section, that's where the first real dose of microbiome happens is going down the birth canal. And obviously it's not a choice for everybody, but that seems to be a big factor in establishing the microbiome.
I'll remind everybody this is a G-rated type podcast. As the next line of questions, we're just about to come out. We'll just stop it right there. Everything's good at this point. However, okay. Anything else on microbiome?
I'm good.
All right. I think you're up again, Scott.
I am. Okay. So we've talked about this on the podcast before, but there are some, thanks to some researchers at Northern Ireland's Ulster University, we now know that smiling while trail running can improve results and lower perceived exertions. Mm-hmm. In fact, Kipchoge, who recently, you know, set the under 2 hour marathon record
unofficially
said that he intentionally smiled every few minutes as he was attempting that. I don't know if he does it on a regular basis, but he did during that record setting event. The only caveat to this is women don't see quite the same benefit as men. Which is interesting. You guys had any smiling studies in your repertoire?
Alex does. I know. We've heard him talk about it.
I'll jump in. I've written about this stuff and it's maybe to my chagrin, it's a calling card that, oh, you're the guy. Oh, I'm smiling now. I must be invincible. It's like, I think I've oversold that research. excuse me. I just got to wash my hands there. Yeah, so the research is interesting. I mean, the big caveat is it's one study and it's a small study. What they found is it seemed to relax people and allow them to run a little bit more efficiently. You can see where the problems arise when you look at some of the sub-analyses, like, oh, it helped men, not women. So does that mean that men respond to smiling better, or does that mean when you break the study down to such a small subgroup, you're not going to see the results relevantly? I mean, some of the discussion, after I wrote about this, I got some quite pointed emails from women saying to me, if I was in a lab and a man told me to smile, you bet I wouldn't be relaxing, because a lot of them, you know, have the experience of being out running and having, jerks calling out to them, hey, smile, sweetie, and things like that. So it's actually something that resonates quite deeply for a lot of women. So And I think that points to a more general point, which is that these sorts of responses are inevitably going to be highly individual. It's not that smiling itself is some, like, you know, your cheek muscles are connected to your hamstrings and they're going to make them fire better. It's putting you in a certain emotional state or something like that. And so, you know, whenever I talk about smiling, some people will say, personally, I've always found I need to get angry to run well. If I'm really fired up, that gets me going. And yeah, that sounds totally reasonable. Like people run better for a variety of different factors and for a variety of different reasons. So I think the smiling thing, I could believe that there is some potential influence of smiling. And especially if you're out in the middle of a race, I find this now, ever since I've been aware of this research, if I'm out doing a hard workout or even a race, sometimes I'll just be like, check in, what's my facial expression right now? Oh, I have the agonized mask of death on my face. I'm like, do I need to have that on? No, it's almost like it's just for show or just by habit, and I can relax my face. And in doing so, I start to feel more relaxed. So, you know, instead of having this grimace. So I think there's something to that, but I think it's definitely not like smile and you'll get 2% faster. I think it's more just like being aware of your mindset and the external manifestations of that mindset can have some impacts on performance.
And it takes energy to make that frown face. What's the old saying? It takes more energy to frown than to smile. Turn that smile upside down, something like, or that frown. Yes.
That extra energy to frown is gonna.
That's 2%
make you slower.
Your breathing muscles are 20%. The frowning muscles are 19%. So that's right.
Almost the same. Almost there. Wasn't there a study that took like people like exercising and they had a screen in front of them and there was like non-perceptible, but they definitely flashed like either a smiling face or a like frowny face, so that you can't actually, the people exercising couldn't detect what sort of face it was. When they were asked, they would guess and they couldn't really tell, but it was long enough for their subconscious to be able to see it. And didn't those people exercise longer, the ones that saw the smiling face? Wasn't there a study that looked like that?
This is a study from Sam Walmart-Korra's group at the University of Kent, and the faces were only up for 16 milliseconds. So yeah, the people didn't even realize there were faces there, but they were perceiving them unconsciously. And I think the time to exhaustion was 12% longer when they were shown smiling faces than frowning faces. And the idea being, you know, you see someone smile, you tend to sort of reflect that automatically and you feel a little bit better about the world. So when you're asking yourself, can I keep going for another 10 seconds? You're just a little bit more likely to say, yeah, sure. Okay. All right, fine. So again, this is a study that I find fascinating. I talk about a lot. It's one study. I'd like to see it replicated. So I you know, I don't want to go to town on like, we now know that the secret to Eliud Kipchoge's greatness is his smiling. No, it's probably his shoes. But I think it's interesting. I think there's a few different data points, like Matt said, pointing in a similar direction.
Good.
I don't think it hurts at all to smile.
No, it doesn't.
And if you're a crew or a pacer, an aid station worker, if you give a smile to somebody that looks like they're having a bad day, I think that's worth its weight in gold.
Amen. Ready for the next one?
Yep, you're up.
All right. Hey, this comes from the exact same article, but it not because
Don only had time to read one.
No,
he's just going to restate the same topic.
No, well, I probably should, because it would probably come out different. So this article, it has a very short paragraph in there, and I would say, part of my first article or first representation of this article talked about the sedentary desk worker and trying to give them a win. And now I'm going over to the overeater, because it said in here, I'm going to read this because I could try to repeat it in another sequence of words, but it wouldn't come out as clear. The researchers examined, they were doing overeating studies. Now that's a great study to volunteer for, an overeating study in which people gorged on food to see how much weight they could gain and how quickly, and found that most of them added pounds at a rate that suggested they could absorb about 2.5 times their basic caloric needs.
Wow.
That is, participants might swallow more calories, but their bodies could not process anything beyond that point. Oh, I'm glad you're shaking your head, Matt, because that sentence made sense to you, which tells me that if I'm going to go ahead and commit to eating some cake, I might as well finish the whole thing, because my body can only absorb so much, and I get a free pass on many of the pieces. Can you support that, Matt?
That does not make
sense. It doesn't make sense, but that's why we're here today.
So I think, isn't this the study where they were trying to figure out like what is the most exercise you could possibly do total? And it was based on essentially the limiting factor for how much exercise you could do was how much you could eat and how much energy you could actually take in. And I feel like that the number was something like Tour de France is not sustainable, that level of exercise. You're gonna have to lose weight during that. Like run across the America, also not sustainable. It's greater than 2.5 times the amount of energy you're burning. So it was somewhere around there that was the most possible like level of exercise that you could do without being a negative caloric balance. But I forget exactly what the number was. I just remember because my wife is currently breastfeeding. We have a 4-month-old, and that breastfeeding was somewhere close to the top of, in terms of how much energy that they you'd expend. It almost doubles, I think, the amount of energy that they that you typically expand, and that was close to the maximal like rate of energy that you can take in. So she's, that's why I'm getting a dad bod and she's staying nice thin at the moment.
Essentially she's on the,
yeah, I blame it on the breastfeeding. Yeah, it has nothing to do with the pizza and beer.
She's running a marathon a day while you are changing your biome through pizza and beer. So Alex, you were shaking your head during Matt's initial comments. It sounds like you have some experience with this.
I wasn't shaking my head. I was just expelling phlegm. No. this is an interesting study. And this is, again, from a guy named Herman Ponser, who I think is now at Duke.
It is. It is Herman Ponser from Duke. It said that in the article. Well done, yes. Alex.
Thank you. Thank you. So the idea here is that no matter how much you really can't absorb more than 2.5 times your basal metabolic rate. So let's say if I lie on the sofa all day, I will burn, let's say 2000 calories, just to make the math easy, that no matter how much I exercise, I cannot absorb more than 5,000 calories a day. And to make that point, he pulls together a lot of different studies from different types of prolonged exertion. And as Matt said, you know, the longest one was pregnancy and lactation. But also you look at the studies he's doing and it's like, oh, there's at 2.4, which is like the highest, is a measurement of 8 Gambian farmers over, I'm reading from an article that I wrote on this, a measurement of 8 Gambian farmers over a 120-day period during harvest. And it's like, okay, so I'm sure those 8 farmers for those 3 months or 4 months, I'm sure they were working really hard, but I'm not sure that's the dot we use to define the upper limit of human capability. I mean, so I think what we can take from this is, it's a plausible idea. We shouldn't get too serious about the number because there's also some conflicting numbers. There's studies of Tour de France cyclists who burn significantly more than that without losing weight, suggesting that they are those trained elite athletes, maybe because they were born that way, or more likely because they had years and years of burning a ton of calories and forcing themselves to eat a lot. They've adapted to be able to eat more. So limit at 2.5 times is a limit in the absence of actually training yourself to be able to consume more calories. And so the overfeeding studies, maybe you do an overfeeding study and you find you can only ingest 2.5 times your metabolic rate. Well, if you do that overfeeding study for 6 months, which would be no longer a great study to volunteer for, maybe you're going to find you can actually start to absorb more calories as the receptors and the transporters in your gut start to respond and realize, hey, there's a ton of energy here. Maybe we can use it. So I think it's an interesting conceptual idea, but I don't recommend going to town on the cake under the assumption that it's not going to get absorbed.
All right. Well, you spoiled that plan.
You just ruined Don's weekend.
All right. Anybody else on that? Are you ready to go, Alex, with your next?
All right. I'll go with my next one, which was, I always find this kind of amusing. Obviously, you know, this podcast doesn't show video, but I'm an extremely skinny and not strong looking guy. But every time I write about strength training, it gets a huge response from the predominantly endurance athletes that I write for. And it's like, wow, I'm an endurance guy mostly writing about endurance for an endurance audience. And every time I write about building muscle, everyone's like, oh yeah, this is great. I want to learn more about this. It's like, oh man, there's something wrong here when you're taking advice from me about strength training. However, I try to read the studies carefully and not to report my own experiences. And one of the studies that made a sort of a big waves in the last year or so was one about how many sets you need to build muscle. And it made the argument that for getting stronger, doing one set of each exercise you do will give you pretty much most of the benefits as doing 3 sets or even 5 sets 3 times a week. So doing 13 minutes 3 times a week was the same as doing like an hour 10 strength training 3 times a week. And for those of us who don't like strength training or would rather be doing something else, that's a very welcome message, much like the don't bother stretching message. So I found that interesting, but it's, I also, you know, I worry that I'm just sort of latching on to studies that seem to tell me what I want. So I'm curious to what, do you guys strength train? And if so, how much do you think we need to do?
I want to hear Don. Don used to be a power lifter. I'd like to get your opinion. He was a bodybuilder. I'll send over a photo later.
Used to be.
Used to be. Transitioned.
Now he's an ultra.
Well, what I like is the theme here. So, you know, eat cake, don't stretch, lift one time, one set to not multiple. I like where we're going. I think strength training, I think it's important. And I think to your point, Alex, I think that if you hit it one time and put that load on the body will adapt. Who says that we need to spend an hour and 10 minutes that week instead of 13 minutes to give that trigger to make the muscles adapt and the ligaments and tendons to thicken and strengthen. So I think that people that like to lift probably spend an hour and 10 minutes in the gym, and the people that don't can spend the 13 and still get a benefit. So I think we're the gym rat. The day for the gym rat is only for the people that like being in the gym. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that we need it to be accomplished endurance athletes, if that's a position that you'll accept.
It's kind of waffly. Like
it was very waffly.
It's kind of waffly. Well,
that's my spot. But I noticed that when Alex brought this up, that Matt was shaking his head like, I know this study. And I think that's what's really cool.
Yeah.
Scott and I are over here with our mouths open, breathing through our mouths. We don't know.
That's all these guys do is read the same articles.
the right ones. So, Matt, what's your take on this?
I remember reading that article and feeling a similar vindication or like actually like reducing the number of sets I would typically do. And so I've taken to the approach of doing one set, but to complete failure. And so that I can't do one more rep beyond that. And so it's kind of like high intensity training, right? Where to do it right, you really have to put yourself through some pain. You don't maybe need that much volume, but it needs to be pretty intense and you need to sort of, go all the way to failure for that. And like Alex, I haven't really been up on the strength training literature. So I've taken to try and do educate myself a little bit more about that. And no disrespect to Trail Runner Nation podcast, but I've been listening to a podcast called Stronger by Science, which if people are interested in the strength side and the science of the strength side, those guys are incredibly educated and well-read on the strength side of stuff.
And we'll link that. We support good podcasts.
Yeah. And they were talking just about this recently in one of their podcasts and saying that actually the more sets you do tend to be better. But I think they are definitely looking for that extra, you know, 1 or 2%. Whereas most runners, you know, we're fine if we get to 95% of the benefit with the one set rather than doing, 15 sets a week or whatever. They talk in completely different language than what I'm typically used to hearing. So it's like 15 sets a week doesn't really make sense to me. I'm like one set three times a week. So that's three sets a week. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Hey, and Matt, when you say sets to failure, how many repetitions are you talking about? When you say go to max till failure, you're talking about 6, 8, 12. Where are you at with that?
I'm trying to keep it under 10 actually. So I'm looking for mostly strength gains without getting a lot of hypertrophy. So if you're trying to get bigger, the recommended rep range is more like 12 to 15 ish. And the lower number of reps, so even less than 10, maybe like 6 or 4, would be ideal for increasing strength without necessarily increasing mass.
Wow. Boy, my intuition said that was the opposite, but I like that you brought that up.
Yeah, which is it does seem counterintuitive, right? And we're like, oh, we're going to do push-ups. We're an endurance athlete, so we're going to do a lot of push-ups. But that might actually increase the amount of mass as well. So like power athletes are doing super short, like when they're in the power phase of their lifting, they're doing, you know, 3 reps, 5 reps, but like maybe 5 sets, as opposed to, like 3 sets of 12, which is what we typically are told to do in the weight room.
I'll just jump in and say I do spend a lot of nights lying awake worrying about getting too muscular. But what I've found is that for most endurance athletes, it's not an issue. There's enough interference between the two modes of training that virtually no ultra runners will ever have to worry about packing on too much muscle. And so you can be a little bit more, you can kind of choose what works best for you. Let's say if you're going to do one set, you probably don't want to let the reps get too low, because it's one thing to do five sets of three super heavy reps or super heavy weights. But if you're doing one set of three, you may not be getting the stimulus you need. There's another body of research over the last 10 years or so from McMaster University that looks at the difference between heavy and light weights. The received wisdom being, of course, that you need to lift fairly heavy weights to gain strength. And what they've found is that actually, as long as you're lifting to failure, the specific number of reps doesn't matter so much. You can lift a light weight and do 20 reps, whatever, get to failure, or you can lift a heavier weight, like 8 to 12 reps in the study that I did was the range they used, 8 to 12, and get to failure. You'll get pretty much the same results. Now, as Matt said, if you're actually going to be competing on the basis of strength or of aesthetics, then you can start to go down all the rabbit holes of different set designs and different periodizations and so on. But if you just want to be reasonably strong so that you're going to be healthy and not going to fall apart, then one set of 8 to 12 or more or less, depending on what you've got available for yourself, is, I think, seems to be kind of get you most of the way there.
And I'll just throw this one comment in there for consideration, that if you're going to go to failure, your risk of injury is higher if you're only going to do 3 reps versus 12 reps. So you got to think about that too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Do you think as a trail ultra running population that we don't do enough strength training?
Yes.
Yes, and I include, even though I consider an ultra run anything over 5K, I include myself in that category. It's one of those things we all know we should do more of, but I just don't enjoy it as much as going out for a run. So it kind of gives me sympathy from when I'm like, the basic building blocks of health are so easy. Just, eat well, go out for a 30-minute jog every day, you'll be healthy. Why don't you do it? Why don't you do it? Well, it's the same thing for me. I know all I should do, all I need to do is some push-ups and pull-ups and, squats twice a week, and I'll be way better off. But I have a heck of a time trying to convince myself to do that.
Yeah, I think I fall in that category as well. Let's see. I think, Matt, is it your turn? This is probably our last topic.
I think so. And the article that I was looking at, another recently published article, and this one's actually in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's a review article on SIBO and EBO. And so do you guys know what nocebo effects are?
Well, repeat that. Your bandwidth broke right up when you gave us those. And that's my excuse for not knowing what they are. But for those listening that might know, what were the two items again?
Placebo and nocebo effects. Oh.
So you know what? I read something recently on that, but I can't remember. Evidently, it didn't stick.
Nocebo.
Nocebo. I don't know.
It's better. To keep your mouth shut than open it up and remove all doubt. So go ahead. Tell us what nocebo and placebo is.
Well, the placebo effect is when we take something that's inert, we know, like a sugar pill, right? And we have a beneficial outcome from it. Mm-hmm. Well, the nocebo effect is the opposite, where we take something that's inert and we have actually a negative effect. And so this study was looking at, or this review article was talking about how somewhere around 20 to 25% of people taking a placebo, so something that we know doesn't do anything, have a negative effect, and they have some sort of side effect that causes them to discontinue using the placebo. So we often talk about how the placebo is so beneficial. Like if we just trick our brains into thinking, that this foam rolling works or this stretching works or whatever it is that we know doesn't actually work, that's fine. It's good enough, right? It's going to be positive on the whole. But there are some people that actually have negative effects from those placebos as well. I think that can come into play for trail running when we, the way we interact with, say, runners as crew, or the way we think about things when we're out on the trail, like the nutrition that we're taking, maybe it's the way we're approaching a hill, how we're using our poles, stuff that might not really have any scientific evidence. But if we think that it might be hurting us, or we might be doing worse because of it, that we could actually have a negative effect from that, or a nocebo effect from that. So I think that thinking about the opposite side of the placebo is something I don't really think about often, but maybe need to think about a little bit more.
I never flipped that coin over, that placebo coin over, to see that there was another side to it. It could actually work against us, and I never even considered that would be a possibility.
I think that's a huge thing. I haven't looked at that study yet, but I'll have to check it out, because I think it's a totally underappreciated effect. And because we often encounter the argument of like, well, the evidence isn't that good in favor of doing X, Y, or Z, but they can't hurt and maybe it'll help. It's like, well, I mean, a simple example, like maybe we should start tracking sleep time with a monitor so that I'll know how well I've slept, and then I can figure out, you know, when I'm just not sleeping well. You wake up in the morning of a race and you check, I only slept 5 hours and 32 minutes last night. I'm screwed. You've got a nocebo right there. You know, or you're like, try this beet juice. It's probably going to help you. There's a chance you're going to get massively explosive diarrhea and it's going to persist for the entire race, but it might make you 1 or 2% faster. You know, you may find that your stomach doesn't feel that good, even if you're taking the placebo beet juice or whatever. So yeah, there's a lot of things where it can't hurt is actually maybe that's not an appropriate way to think about these things. If you're doing something, doing an intervention.
You're only getting faster between outhouses. You're all time, not faster.
It's a good interval workout.
Yeah.
Oh, this has actually been a really good podcast. I've learned quite a bit.
I was on a run, and it was a race, bibbed race, and somebody had asked me about this at an aid station. There was a product to help with cramping, and I never heard of it before. And I don't even know if you rubbed it on you or put it on, you know, wore it or took it in you. But she asked, I hope she's not listening. She asked, is this stuff any good? And what am I going to say? Absolutely. That stuff is solid. If you take that, you will not have cramping this race or your next. And there's no harm in that, you know?
That's the right answer. Yeah.
So I tried to positive placebo and not a nocebo on her.
Yeah, it's better than saying, well, it might work.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never tried it.
You know, I'm going to start using the word nocebo and placebo as I label people. Oh. You know, there are some people that are nocebo type people that's all they think about is the negative.
Mm.
That's what that's the way I'm gonna discreetly label people.
Where are you gonna put me, Scott?
You're a placebo. Oh, absolutely. Good. Absolutely.
Gentlemen, this was fun, and the best part is I have my best study reserved for the next time we do this. If you guys are in,
you read more than one article.
Yes,
it's the same article, but he's got getting to paragraph three.
three different bullet points from the same article.
Fair enough. I mean, I can't dispute that. The facts are the facts.
Hey, make sure you go to Sweat Science and check out some of the articles that Alex is writing, and go to CharmanUltra.com and pick up a good coach named Matt Lay.
And sure also his article, sorry, Scott, inside of Ultra Running Magazine, as he's a contributing editor there. Yep. Always good information.
Yep. So thank you guys for joining us. We hope you guys have a good day. Alex, I hope that you don't have to take those antibiotics, and so you don't have to go eat Korean food for dinner tonight.
Fingers crossed. I'll report back next time with a personal N=1 case study.
Experiment of one. That's what we're expecting, a paper on that in the next 10 days.
Thank you, gentlemen. Awesome. Now go out and wash your hands.
Moss.
All right. Hey, guys,